cleverness, nor silly talk, nor levity, which are not fitting. But instead let there be thanksgiving. Be sure of this, that no immoral or impure man, or one who is covetous, that is, an idolater, has any inheritance to the kingdom of Christ. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for it is because of these things that the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore do not associate with them. For once you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true. And try to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it is a shame even to speak the things that they do in secret. But when anything is exposed with the light, it becomes visible. Or anything that becomes visible is light. Therefore it is said, Awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give you light. Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of the time, because the days are evil. Thank you, Jimmy, for that reading. We're thankful for the presence of each one of you here this morning. We're speaking again this morning on the Christian's task. For the last, well, the two previous Sundays, we've been talking about the task as the congregation as a whole, the task of individuals in creating and maintaining the new man, or receiving the new man in ourselves. Today we're going to be studying what the task of the church as a group and individual Christians is as far as our fighting a battle that we're locked into today and cannot get out of. And today I want to bring to your attention some things that will be necessary for you and me to understand in order for us to do this battle that God has placed us in. About 2 years ago, an article in the Time magazine pointed out a meeting that took place in Manhattan. The meeting was among about 100 what it called prominent intellectuals. The subject of the meeting was the end of the rationalist era, or the end of the rationalist tradition. And rationalism here, and reason in contrast to faith and a God-centered universe. And the rationalist tradition has been holding fort for the last several decades. And now we're talking about, is this the end of it? And these prominent intellectuals who had been a part of it now made this statement, and among other things they said, Robert Lowell, the poet, said the world is absolutely out of control now, and it's not going to be saved by reason or unreason. Norman Mailer made this statement, somewhere something incredible happened in history. The wrong guys won. Both of these men were a part of an atmosphere that this writer says consisted of gloom hanging over this whole meeting, a pessimism about the outcome of the world and the outcome of the whole fight of humanity for what's right and good. These two men, though they speak of the battle as already being passed, and they speak of it in terms that were not encouraging, I don't believe the battle is passed, and I don't believe the outcome has given the victory to those who are opposed to God. In fact, in last week's ruling by the Supreme Court, we were served notice that the battle is not over. And I'll tell you what, I thank God for those men who had the determination and the conviction to stand up and give those of us who are trying to hold ourselves up by whatever means available, trying to elevate this society, they gave us some hope. And I want us to consider not just this, this was just a passing thing that came up incidentally, but I think it's one of the most significant decisions that has been made by the Supreme Court in many a year. And I think we need to consider where we fit into it, and what is the position of the church, and what part of this picture do we play, and what is our role. I think, for one thing, that we could pray for these men and thank God for them. We can pray for them and tell them to stick in there and to do what they know is right and to not let people frighten them by what they consider maybe public opinion, but to do what they know is best for this country. I would like to see every one of us write a letter of appreciation to the Supreme Court, because they're going to get a lot of flack. The Gazette here in Arkansas has already given them 2 days of it, of re- rebuke and rebuttal and flack that would simply say you're wrong, you've made the wrong decision. But I'd love to see every one of us. We can do that as individual Christians. We can't hand down official decisions. I know that. There's no machinery for that. And we're not to stand up here, and I'm not to get involved in social political issues. We're not to stage protest marches for or against the Vietnam War. We're not to get involved about the many things, the higher wages or better housing. And we're not, that isn't our task. We're not getting involved in that sort of a thing. But I'll tell you, when the morals of America are at stake, and when we're given a foothold and a crack and a screwdriver in the door to open up a door for better things like we've been given this past week, I think we need to take advantage of it and do something about it. Where does the church fit into this? We are engaged in a battle. Make no mistake about it. And I pray to God this morning that I'll be able to say what needs to be said in a manner and with clarity enough that will convince you and convict you, as I have been convicted in the study of this lesson, so that we can see what our task is. And I hope you'll follow with me through this lesson. And one of the main things that we're going to have to do, I guess, this morning is to realize that we're not going to be able to watch our clocks if we're going to win this battle against evil. We're not going to make it out of here on time this morning, and I don't really care. We don't have any other people coming in here. We're in here for the rest of the day if you want to be. And if you can't stay with us till I get through, then you're excused, and may God bless you. But we've got a battle to do. And we need to be about our battle. We're engaged in a battle, and it is against not blood and flesh, Paul says here in Ephesians, the 6th chapter and verse 12. We're not doing battle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the world rulers of this darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. That's with whom we're to do this battle. The equipment with which we're to do the battle is also listed here in Ephesians, the 6th chapter. We're going to study that tonight. But the mode of operation and the plan of the battle, the plan of the attack, is listed in what Jimmy read just a moment ago here in Ephesians, the 5th chapter, verses 3 through 16. And we've just read that text, and from the text I want to draw some lessons that will give you an idea as to what our task really is regarding this battle against evil. From this text I learned this one thing at least, that if we're going to be successful in this battle, we're going to have to be a people prepared for the battle in at least three different ways. We're going to have to be a people who are able to discern the times. Let me substitute, if you don't mind. And I'm going to take this liberty. I believe these things that I'm going to say. I want to, if I possibly can. I've been trying all week to figure out a way to say it in a concise manner where you would get the impact of what this is saying. I don't know whether I can or not, but let me substitute the word American for Roman. And as we go down this again, I'm going to give this same reading, and I want to substitute the counterpart in the 20th century society. Listen closely. In our day, virtue has given way to luxury and sensuality. All the ranks of American society are infected with the prevailing impurity. Vices which may not even be named are practiced with impunity. Slavery encourages sensual indulgence. We don't have slavery today like they did back then. But what these writers were talking about was the female slave being brought into the economic system of the Roman Empire, to where the woman was brought into close proximity with and was brought into intimate and even private association with men other than her husbands, other than her husband, other than their husbands. And this proved to be one of the most basic, the basic financial arrangements, the economic arrangements of the whole Roman world. If you had taken the slave system out of the Roman economy, it would have collapsed overnight. Today, the parallel to that is simply this, and I'm going to say this because I believe it with all my heart. The female working force in America today, beyond any shadow of a doubt, is one of the most significant contributing factors to the decay of morality that America has ever experienced. And if you were to take it out of our economic system, I know our economic system would collapse. But you have the same thing exactly in the female slaves of the first century that so led to a moral decline. We have that same thing today where women have been forced into the economic fact, into the economic picture of America today. They've been forced into being associated with and being forced into being dependent upon men other than their husbands. And they dress to please them, they work to please them, and they're brought into such close union with these men that they've contributed, I'm confident, to the great downfall and weakening of our moral structure. But let me go further. Infanticide was freely tolerated. We don't practice infanticide. We practice abortion. They used to take the babies out and put them on the countryside and let someone, some beast, come and eat them. We just take ourselves to the doctors and let the doctors put the babies in a garbage can, and then they take them and do something else with them. The Roman stage, the circus, the amphitheater, if you don't believe that the degradation of morals in our present society is most, what he calls here, is most apparent in our theaters and all, then you need to take another look. Divorce is coming to be looked upon with utmost indifference as a commonplace fact in ordinary social life. The loss of belief in the old religion and the growing laxity of morals led to an extraordinary freedom of divorce. No remedy is now being found for such a disorder so universal. You see how parallel it is to what Paul's day was? That's what he was talking about. And this is what this application is to you and me today. And then you add to that our spiraling crime rate, our drug addiction, our alcoholism, add to it the great onslaught of pornography, add to that all the things that are being done today to destroy the very basis of our whole society, and you get what E. de Brissac said about his impression of the first century Roman world. He said, we find ourselves in a sink of vice. And if you want to say today that, well, you've gone crazy and you're off on a tangent, well, that's all right, but somebody's got to say something about it, and I want to be at least one of them. We have put all America on the alert, Jerry Rubin says in his book called The Prophetic Minority. We have put all Americans on the alert. We have mixed young people, music, sex, drugs, revolt, and treason together. What other combination would be as effective? What we need is a new generation of obnoxious people, a new generation of bizarre, unbalanced, irrational people obsessed with sex, angry, irreligious, infantile, and crazy. People who burn their draft cards, people who attract young people with music and hold them with marijuana and LSD, people who proudly wave the Viet Cong flag, people who aren't afraid to say obscenities on television. That's what the battle is. These are some of the people that are trying to get us to be destroyed, or trying to get us to destroy ourselves. They're trying to undermine everything that we hold to be true and that we hold to be pure and right. The battle is on. And if you and I are going to do the battle that we ought to be doing, we're going to have to realize that there is a battle being fought. And that you and I in Searcy, Arkansas, as badly as we many times, or as much as we are shaded and sheltered from the true situation in the world around us, we are sheltered from it here. But we're going to have to use this as a preparing ground to go out into the world to do battle against this very thing that we're talking about this morning. And I want to encourage you to be a part of it. First of all, then, I simply say that we're going to have to be a people who discern the time. We're going to have to know what's going on. And whenever then things are sounded forth from this pulpit or from the classrooms or from wherever it may be sounded forth, from your own mother and father, whenever they begin to give you warnings about things that are happening in the world and try to prepare you for them, you young people, listen to those people. And don't just poo-poo them and dismiss them with disgust. They're telling you about things that you may not have experienced yet, but nonetheless are true. But a second thing, not only are we going to have to be aware of what's going on, we're going to have to get our head out of the sand. But second, we're going to have to be a people totally committed to a life of purity ourselves. This is what he mentions in Ephesians, the 5th chapter, and verse 3. He says there are some things that do not even deserve the honor of being argued. There are some things that are not to be given even the honor of being debated as far as them being appropriate and in place in the Christian life. He says there are some things, and he names these things. He says there are immorality, impurity, and covetousness. Immorality and impurity, I think, are both clear. I think we know what they are. They deal with sexual immorality. These words are used almost exclusively to indicate sexual immorality, sexual impurity. The one here that's covetousness, perhaps we haven't wanted to know what it meant. But it means, I think, more than what we've been afraid of that it meant. For example, I read a statement, I'm going to quote it here, from a man commenting on the Greek word that's used here and its prevalence in the New Testament and how it's used. He says this thing of covetousness is not just the coveting of money, but it is, quote, the vice of self-assertion, ruthless in trampling on the rights of others, concerned with nothing but the satisfaction of its own impulses. This thing of covetousness is the key to the whole viciousness of pagan worldly life, as love is the key to the whole goodness of the Christian life. And if you'll contrast and look at the difference between chapter 5, verse 2, and then verse 3, you'll see these two different philosophies of life laid out in very clear way, in a very clear way. Listen, if you will. Verse 2, and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. That's the Christian philosophy. We're to walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us. Then listen to the worldly philosophy. Immorality, impurity, covetousness, this thing of doing everything to get others to serve us. This thing of imposing upon others. This thing of using other people. This thing not of giving ourselves up for them, but of finding every way imaginable to dupe them and to bring them into such a way that we'll get to take advantage of them. That's the philosophy of the world. And these two things, he simply says, these three things, immorality, impurity, and this thing of covetousness, where you, by this self-assertion, you're ruthless in trampling on the rights of others, concerned with nothing but the satisfaction of your own impulses. This is the key to the whole viciousness of the worldly life, and that's true. And he contrasts these two in verses 2 and verse 3. He says these things are not even to be named among you. They're not even to be discussed. Anyone who would think about being immoral, he's to be just simply, it's not even to be discussed. Is it right to have premarital intercourse? That's not even to be discussed in Christian circles. And you young people who look with disgust upon any teacher that just simply says, that sort of thing just simply has no place in a discussion at all. Let me tell you one thing. He's standing on sound biblical ground. You may like to argue the question, but let me tell you, go get your Bibles and see what the Bible says about it and see how that some things don't even deserve the right to be argued as having a place in the Christian life. But then there's three other things that he mentions. Filthiness, silly talk, and levity. These three things, what do they mean? Filthiness, I think I know what that means. It means any kind of immoral expression, either by word or action or symbol or sign, that would degrade and demoralize, that would be filthiness. Silly talk. I don't know whether I know what silly talk means. It may mean that kind of tantalizing, what is that word, that kind of the tantalizing dropping of a scent, you know, and a kind of a hint here that would cause people to be pulled down and made less than what they ought to be. This kind that goes on at all the banquets where people associate in such a vulgar fashion, where they kind of play word games with each other. I think that would be called silly talk. But then he talks about here this thing of levity, and he's not talking about this good, clean merriment that you make as you try to lighten people's loads in life. That's not what he means by this expression here of levity. He's talking about this, and this is a statement also from one looking at the word itself, not objecting to good, clean merriment, but to the practice of making a joke of indecency. This is the whole context of this thing. He's not talking about, as I say, making someone's load lighter by some kind of a joking of in life. He's talking about looking at the impurities of life and looking at these indecencies and taking into consideration all the corruptions in life and then dismissing them with some kind of a joke or in a light-handed manner that would indicate that you've really been gotten to after all and you don't take these things as seriously as they ought to be talked, as they ought to be taken. This is what he's talking about here, I think, by levity. Well, we need to be a people totally committed to a life of purity. He not only wants you to abstain from this thing of immorality and impurity and covetousness, but he says it goes beyond that. You're not to even be involved in this thing of silly talk or in this thing of levity or even making light of it that would indicate that you've been gotten to and that you really don't consider it as bad as it really is. But then a third thing. He says here we're going to have to stand firm in our attitude towards sin. In verse... Precisely that the battle will be lost or won. You're not going to win it anywhere else. It's going to be won or lost in the attitudes of Christian people. Let me give you an illustration of it. I think that communism's threat to America is going to be determined by the attitudes of Americans toward communism. I think that's where the battle is lost or won. Dr. Benson and others have been preaching this for how many years? That it's the attitude that we have toward communism that will determine the outcome of communism's threat to America and to the world. And if you don't believe it, look at West Germany today. Germany today is a divided nation. You know why? Because in the time of the Second World War, as the time came for the treaties to be signed and all, at the end of the war, because of either ignorance or blindness or whatever on the part of American leaders concerning the nature and the threat of communism, because of that ignorance, America allowed the communist countries to walk right into the thing, divide the nation of Germany, and it's that way till this very day, and it's one of the hot spots of the world. That's because of the fact that they did not firm up their attitude toward communism. When General Douglas MacArthur was fighting in the Korean War, his very leadership in that war was stripped away from him. He was not allowed to govern or to direct that war. You know why? Because he found himself incompatible with an attitude that would fight a war and yet not go all out to win it. That's exactly why he walked away. That's why he was stripped from him and his leadership was taken away. He wasn't allowed to lead any further. General Douglas MacArthur, one of the main things that he ever said was this: there is no substitute for victory. And if the world had allowed General Douglas MacArthur and others to go on and do what war is usually for, and nobody's for it, but who ever heard of fighting a war and not going in to win it? So it is with this thing of sin. Our attitude towards sin is going to determine whether or not we win the battle or not. But just as sure as we're as blind as the people toward communism, just that certainly will sin finally envelop the church. And I'll tell you one thing, we're raising a generation of people who like the musical. We've grown accustomed to her face. My generation, I think, is part of it. Your generation, those of you who are younger than I, you also are a part of it. And your generation has grown more and more accustomed to this thing of the face of sin. And someone wisely said, vice is a monster of so great mien, but to be hated is but to be seen. But seen too often, familiar with her face, we first pity, then endure, then embrace. And that's true. And we've come to the place today in America, in the church, in America, that we cannot actually stand up and identify sin, because there are too many of the leaders in the church that are involved in it. And there are too many members of the church that it would embarrass. One of my good friends here told about being in his preaching, and he preached on such things as drinking and dancing and immorality and immodesty. And the elders took him aside and said, look, tell us what lascivious, or tell us against lasciviousness. Preach against lasciviousness, he said, but don't tell us what it is. Just preach against lasciviousness. What's happening? Well, the thing that's happened is that we've gotten infirm. We've become sick in our regard toward sin and our attitude toward sin. But I'll tell you one thing, God's attitude toward sin hasn't changed. And Paul mentions it here, and you'd have to decide whether you're only on God's side or on Satan's side. Listen to this. It is because of these things that the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. This is what God's attitude is towards sin. He has revealed his wrath against it. This is what Paul says in Romans, the first chapter, verse 18. He says that if the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men that hinder the truth in unrighteousness, that's God's official attitude. That's his official statement that he's handed down to the sons of men, that I hate sin and I have poured out my wrath upon it, both now and in the day of judgment. And I don't know where you want to stand. I think I know. But young people, may I say this, and old people, you better take your stand. You better decide whether you're going to stand on the side of God or the side of the world, because they're not the same side. In 1 Corinthians, the sixth chapter, verses 9 and 10, the same language is used there. Don't be deceived, it said, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor homosexuals, nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor extortioners. None of these, he said, are going to inherit the kingdom of God. Well, I'll tell you what, how dare we then put ourselves on the side of that against which God's wrath has been revealed? How dare we endorse homosexuality when God's wrath has been revealed against homosexuality? But you say, well, that's right. Preach on, brother. There's not a homosexual within 100 miles of here. Well, maybe, maybe not. But how dare we endorse alcoholic drink? How dare we endorse liquor or endorse whiskey whenever you see the statistics against it? How dare we endorse anything else that statistics exist on? I could read some things, if I had time this morning, that would maybe make your hair stand on end. We dare not endorse anything that God has already placed his censor against. We dare not endorse dancing. The modern dance is one of the most effective tools of Satan to get you to lower your moral standards. And the statistics out on it are so clear that there's no questioning it. The only thing you're going to have to decide is whose side you're going to stand on. How dare we endorse the mini dress, the mini skirts, or the mini whatever it is, that have been created for the very purpose of seducing people. How can you endorse it? How can you condone it? How can you even overlook it or minimize it? Or how can you encourage others to do it? And sometimes you mothers are as involved in this thing as your daughters. You encourage them to do it by the very fact that you don't take a stand and show them something better. But listen to this. Mini clothes are symbolic. This is the woman who made the mini dress. Mary Quant of London, designer and mother of the miniskirt, said on November the 13th, 1968, mini clothes are symbolic of those girls who want to seduce a man. Listen, girls. Mini clothes are symbolic of those girls who want to seduce a man. And, as if to confirm, and this is the quote, that's the end of her quote, this man here, Paul Harvey, says, and as if to confirm her conclusion, the year the skirts went up, crimes against women demonstrated a parallel increase. For example, FBI crime files show that the rate of forcible rape, which had been declining for 5 years, shot upward in 1964, the year that the skirts went up, and has continued to do so ever since. In England, where the short skirts had a head start, the rape rate increased 90%. In the United States, the increase has been 68%. Last year, forcible rapes increased more than any other violent crime. Is there a correlation? The consensus of law enforcement officers in 50 states says yes. Well, let me just say this, and I probably don't preach on it enough, but I want to go on record as saying that any Christian woman who is that unconcerned about her Christian influence that she would follow along the customs of the world and dress in such a way as to incite lust in another man, she is as guilty as the man that lusts after her. And we need to realize that there's a battle going on. And if you don't recognize the power of your body as a woman and what it is capable of doing, you may be really, well, you may not be harmless, but you'll probably get into heaven all right. You don't have enough sense to recognize things that are so obvious that anybody that can see through a ladder knows. God's attitude towards sin is just simply this. He's put his wrath against it. And I'll tell you what, before I would be found sitting in a position that would be fighting against God, and Gamaliel in Acts the 5th chapter said, look, let's be careful, we're liable to find ourselves sitting in a position of fighting against God. Before I'd find myself fighting against God, may God strike me dead and take me on to be with him before I get into that position of fighting against God. But there's a final thing that must be said. He mentions here in verses 7 and verse 11 three things that are to be our attitude. He mentions three specific statements that I want to turn over to you this morning. Number one, he says, do not associate with them. Number two, he says, take no part in them. And number three, he says, instead, expose them. These three admonitions are not just admonitions. These are three charges. He says, don't have any or do not associate with them. The genitive of this pronoun here forces us, those who are the linguists tell us, this forces us to conclude that he's talking about the people who are involved in all of this corruption. He says, don't have any association with those people. And young men, let me tell you, the best way you can ruin your life as a young man that will carry over into later life until you die is to get caught in this web of running around with the wrong kind of boys or the wrong kind of girls. You may find in them, and you may be blind to their faults. That doesn't matter. You may find in the things that you really love and enjoy. That really is not the issue. The point is, what direction are they going? And if they're going in a wrong direction, for you to condone their conduct by associating with them, and the word here for associate doesn't just mean go in among them and try to convert them. Oh, no. The word associate here is a word that's kin to the word fellowship, not in literal root, but in idea. It's kin to the word fellowship in the sense that it means that you're there in the sense of endorsement. You're there because you condone what they're doing. You're there either because you think it's kind of funny or you're maybe enjoying it, though you're not doing it yourself, but you're associating with those that do. He said, do not do that. And the instruction in Psalms, the first chapter in verse 1, is still holding and binding on us today. Happy is the young man that doesn't run around where sinners run around, that doesn't sit in the seat of scoffers, that doesn't stand in the way of sinners, who doesn't stand around where sinners stand around. But there's a second thing. First of all, he says, just don't have any association with them. More good boys are ruined because of the association of their fellows than any other cause, I guess, on earth. The associates that you run with. What kind of people are you running with? And I can tell when my boys are beginning to kind of drift away, or I can tell it by the way they run with a certain crowd of people. And I talk with them about it and try to encourage them to run with people that will make you a better person. And if you're going to associate with other people, do it as an evangelist. Do it as one who's going out to help save the world from the very things those people are practicing. But the second thing is this. Take no part in them, he said. This is the dative. This pronoun here is dative, which implies take no part in the sins that those people are having a part in. And that just simply means, translated down into Searcy, Arkansas, it means that lewd, filthy films, if you're a movie proprietor or a movie house proprietor, don't show those films. Have nothing to do with it. Take no part in them. If you're a movie goer, don't go to those films. And that's just simply a statement from the Lord. Don't associate and have any part in those things that are going the opposite direction to what I want the world to go, he's saying. Don't have any part in them. Pornographic books and magazines, don't buy them or sell them. If you have a magazine store, or if you have a magazine rack in the store where you work or where you own, or that you own, just simply do not sell that trash and that film. If you are a magazine reader, don't read it. That's just about as plain and simple as I can get. Degrading music by degraded musicians, that the more subtle A way of getting into the minds of people never has been devised. If you're a music listener, don't listen to Alice Cooper and the likes of that kind of music. Just don't do it. If you sell musical records, if your livelihood depends on it, I don't care. Trust in the God that saved you. Don't sell that kind of trash. Just simply don't take any part in it. Are you able to do that? Unless we're willing to take a united stand, as Paul told the Philippians, standing side by side in the gospel, and unless each one of us can count on the others, we're not going to win this battle. But I'll tell you, we stand at a focal point in, and as a, at a focus point here in this community, I think it's unparalleled in the whole United States. We've got more of an opportunity to make a show for good here in this community than any other place in the United States. But listen, I would also encourage those of us who are involved in the Christian battle to not imitate the materialism or the covetousness or the greed or the hypocrisy of the older generation. I would also encourage us to not be a partner to the blindness and the sins and the looseness and the hypocrisy of the younger generation. Don't have any part with either one of the generations. That part of it that's not right, just because something is done by the old doesn't make it wrong. Just because something is done by the young doesn't make it right, nor vice versa. It's just simply always right to do right, and it's always wrong to do wrong. You can't make that clear distinction between right and wrong. Go to your Bible. God will help you. He'll advise you in these things through His Word. But then the third thing is, well, let me just say this. One day and you may think, oh boy, this really shows he's off his nut. But I've got 5 children, and I pray for them every day. And not a, practically an hour goes by, but what I take stock of myself, take stock of what I'm doing, take stock of the way I'm training them. They're on my mind constantly. They were out with me one day, and we were going along in the car, and one of them saw somebody with a great big long fork, you know, on his motorbike. Looked like he'd hit a tree, and the fork kept going. It was about 5 feet long, and Paul went up and said, look at there. Ooh, isn't that cool? He said, I'm going to get my bicycle and make it like that. I said, well, boy, it's not as long as you live in my house, you're not. Oh, and they said, what do you mean? What's the length of the fork of your bicycle got to do with anything right or wrong? I said, for just this one simple reason, it indicates a whole trend of thinking that I just don't go along with. And I don't have any respect for those who do go along with it. And I said, listen, you and I would be involved in a constant do this and don't do this all of our lives. Boys, I said, I never would get around to telling you everything to do or don't do. I said, let me just give you this general rule of thumb. Don't do anything, don't wear anything, don't say anything that would imply to anybody that you're on the other side. We're fighting for God. And don't let anything that you do or that you wear or that you sign or that you, whatever it may be, don't let it indicate to anybody that you're giving quarter whatsoever to any kind of an attitude that's on the other side of God. We're on God's side. And that's all I know to tell you. Don't do anything, don't wear anything, don't say anything, don't listen to anything, don't entertain anything that would make the world think that, by the way, you know, that person, they're sympathetic to our revolution. They're sympathetic to what's going on. They're sympathetic to this new morality. No, sir, you cannot afford to be sympathetic to it. It said it instead expose them. That's in chapter 5, verse 11. Expose them. That just simply means to speak out. It means to endorse that that's right, and it means to condemn that that's wrong. And I think negatively, it just simply means this. It means to stand up and say, wait a minute, I'm a follower of Jesus Christ, and I don't act like that. I'm a follower of Jesus Christ, and I don't wear that. I'm a follower of Jesus Christ, and I wear more than that. I'm a follower of Jesus Christ, and I don't listen to that. But that's not enough. There's got to be a positive application of our influence for good so that we don't just serve as a negative influence. There's got to be a positive salting of the world if we're going to be any good influence. And this is involved here when he says, rather expose them. You know the best way to expose evil? Is to put good up beside it. That's the best way to expose something that's wrong. Put something good up beside it. And I want to say this. What would be wrong and what would keep us as a community of people? Why don't you in the high school set your own length of dress? Why don't you set it in accordance with the Lord Jesus Christ? Why don't you examine what it would be that would be conducive to morality? Why don't those of you in the high school or in the college age, in the, what would you call, the home economics classes, why don't you turn out what you would call a book, what do you call these things, the catalog, mail order catalog, That's not what I'm after either. But why don't you prepare a collection of dress designs of things that would be very appealing, very beautiful, and yet they would be very becoming a Christian? What would be wrong, and why couldn't you do that? Why can't we set our own standards? Why can't we, when we began to sell music here in this whole city, and as you began to get these things out into the community, why can't it be recognized this music store belongs to a Christian? He's not going to be selling this trash, and we can go there for good music. Why can't it be that in everything that we do, we can stand up and the people will say, well, you know, they're not just against everything. Those people are providing an alternative. They're providing an option, and thank God for them. These are some of the things that Paul mentions here when he simply says, don't have anything to do with them, have no part in what they're doing, but rather stand up and expose them. And you're going to have to stand up. And the time has come, by the way, and maybe with this decision of the Supreme Court, maybe now is our prime time to stand up and say, right, you've given us the right to do something and then be backed by the laws of the land, and we're going to do it. And let's stand up for the Lord and make our vote count in this thing of the fight against immorality. Would you stand and commit yourself to it this morning? And commit yourself, if necessary, publicly. If you want to become a Christian and begin the fight, come confessing your faith and be baptized into the Lord. If you've been a wishy-washy Christian and you haven't really taken your stand, stand up for the Lord right now while we stand and sing.